Sean Kenny is with me. He's a contributing editor at The Bering Drift. Make sure you find them on Facebook and online. It's beringdrift.com. It's Virginia's conservative voice. And there is also, it's SeanKenny.com.
Yeah, I have that as well.
So. S-H-A-U-N. And really quickly, the markets of Tiger Fuel forecast. It's going to get nicer. How about, can we just leave it at that? I'm a big believer in the simple forecast.
Will there be a sun?
There's going to be a sun.
That's amazing.
They say. Yeah, it's supposed to be a relatively nice week, right? It's going to get warmer, and hopefully the rain will stop.
Yeah.
It's been over a month, right?
The sun is like climate change. Total myth. It doesn't exist.
The sun doesn't exist.
Have you seen, when's the last time you saw the sun? I haven't seen it.
I think it's out there now.
No, that's a reflection off the cars.
Oh, my gosh. You told me during the break there was some breaking news, right?
Yeah, apparently the Department of Justice under the FBI has started to investigate Terry McAuliffe, governor of Virginia, for investigation on his campaign contributions linked to the Global Initiatives Fund.
What?
Yes.
Do you know anything about this? Who's investigating? The feds?
Feds. Yeah. FBI. The Obama DOJ is investigating this. It's under the Clinton Global Initiatives. That's exactly what it is.
I don't even know what that is.
The blurb is like really, really short on CNN. They're the ones who broke it. So, interesting question mark. But I'd kind of like to know a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're all corrupt.
Yeah. Wow.
And you, and I don't mean evil. I just mean corrupt.
Well,
because the way they do business is, as far as I'm concerned, it's the very definition of corruption.
I mean, how do you catch a criminal? Make everything a crime? I mean, this is why I like Virginia's system. Just as long as you report it, it's okay. just report everything, and then you're fine. You know, at least then I know where it's all going. I mean, at least I can see the cesspool.
Would you support a gift ban? Because they keep saying, you know, it's
if the gift ban were total, yes.
Oh, yeah. And that has long been Larry Sabato's recommendation. Just no gifts.
No gifts.
None at all.
Period.
Yeah. None. I'm a member. I'm an elected member of a public body. Mm-hmm. I'm not allowed to take your gift.
Yeah.
I mean, see me when I'm done, and I'm out of office. Yeah. And then, you know.
When I was elected office, I never took a single gift. I was very proud of that. It's and there's a reason why. It's because it's public service. You're not there to enrich yourself. You're there to serve the public.
But if you're Tommy Normant in the General Assembly, you like going on those big hunting trips.
Yeah.
Man. Those very, very expensive hunting trips that corporate America wants to take you on.
Or the
box seats at the ball game.
Yeah.
Or, you know,
or
whatever it is.
Or the junkets to Las Vegas. You know, things of this nature where you get to go to the Alec conference.
There you go.
Whatnot. I mean, it happens on both sides, Coy. I mean,
of course it does. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Should it happen? Absolutely not. Now, I will say this. There is some value in getting elected officials into a room and having them hear a certain perspective. I don't care if it's Alec. I don't care if it's... Cato, Heritage, New American Century, whatever the case may be, right? There is an advantage to having everybody in the room and doing a symposium and getting best practices. I don't have a problem with that. But the problem is that when those best practices are happening in the, you know, Wynn Hotel on the strip of Las Vegas. Behind locked doors. Yeah. I mean, that's a problem to me. I mean,
corruption.
C-SPAN ought to be there recording every single instance of it. And yeah, you're right.
The one good thing is that some significant big names are pulling out of ALEC, the conservative legislative conference or whatever it is there. And that's good news. I think Ford pulled out. They recognize that, you know, this is corruption.
Sure.
You know, this is literally buying votes.
Yeah. But some of it too is it's work overload, right? And I think this is something, especially at state government, right? I mean, you've got literally 3,000 bills going through the General Assembly. I mean, everything's crisscrossing one way or another. You tend to lead on expertise in order to figure out which is good and which are bad bills. And so what happens then is it comes away from the representatives and it starts going to the lobbyists, and they start leaning on the lobbyists and their think tanks and saying, how should I vote on that bill?
Yeah, you know now, more about this than I do.
Yeah. Now, to me, that is the fundamental corruption right there. It's because I don't elect a representative, a delegate, a state senator, you know, supervisor, city councilman, whatever the case may be. I don't elect them so they can go back to a lobbyist and say, how should I vote on this? You elect them so that they can go ahead and weigh the scales in their own living room, in their own office, you know, wherever the case may be, so that they can make those determinations and not go back to the lobbyist and say, how should I think on
this?
And
we have the Democrats to thank for that, because it starts with Walter Lippmann in the 20s, and then you fast forward, it really takes full bloom under Barack Obama. But it's this idea that the professional expert should be the one who runs everything because they know more than everybody else.
The technocrats.
And you've enshrined the technocrats, and it's a very liberal way of thinking that, well, they know better. But what happens when the technocrats are wrong? Welcome to the Clinton administration.
Look at what we've done on the right, though. I mean, Heritage and Cato and all the other think tanks that bloomed around Washington in the 70s and 80s. I mean, all the Republicans did was, again, they built a simulacrum of what they thought was working for the left. And now what runs K Street? I mean, it's by and large Republican shops that are sitting there cranking out ideas and then feeding them to legislators.
And this has become Washington. It's just all these technocrats and I'm an expert of this, and look at my Yale degree but what if you're wrong?
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
That's the whole point.
Exactly.
You were wrong about the economy. All these smart guys sitting in the room, and they're convinced. It's not evil. They're convinced that if we can just take care of Wall Street and bail out Wall Street, then the money will just trickle down and everyone will be fine. And they're wrong.
They're
100% wrong.
It would have been so much better paying off everybody's credit card. I mean, even though there's moral hazard involved in that, I'm not saying it's the right thing or wrong thing to do. But you would have been better off paying off everybody's credit cards all the way across and just saying, you know what? Here, tax holiday, debt jubilee, it's done. And let Wall Street...
Instead of the trillion to Wall Street.
Yeah, so the trillion to Wall Street...
disappeared into,
put the trillion to the middle class.
Gave us a whole new oligarch... 0.1% class. Mm-hmm. What if we had instead? And you're right. It's just as twisted on the other side. But if you want the biggest bang for your buck as the investment of the community, what if you had forgiven everyone's credit card debts? If you had paid off everyone's mortgage,
right?
The economy would have gone through the roof. Well, it would have boomed.
People have continued their bad spending habits is what would have happened. And then we would have pretty much arrived at another bubble in a future rate. So, I mean, it's not like either one is the right thing. I'm certainly not advocating that we just go ahead and pay off everybody's debts. But, but the thing is the thought experiment is worth going through, right? Because it tells you, it's like, what's better for America in the long run? Is it a capitalized market, or is what's better for the long run a capitalized middle class? And I tend to lean on the latter. And as conservatives used to, anyway.
Look at Henry Ford. Look at it. Henry Ford's the perfect example. I can get this working class to make these cars, and I can have these beautiful cars that could change the world that only a fraction of the people could ever buy.
Right.
That the people who make them could never afford. I could be happy with that. I could make a living. Mm-hmm. Or I can raise the salary of my workers and share what I'm making.
Yep.
With my workers who are actually making the product. That's not socialism.
Mm-mm.
To me, that's capitalism, because he recognized they're all going to be able to afford to buy the cars they're making.
Yeah.
I'll make more money.
And they're the best ambassadors for your product, right?
Yep. And he recognized that.
Yep.
That's capitalism.
Yep. Yep. It leans a little bit more on the distributist side, but that's close. I'll take that.
Speaking of that, there was a recent interview with Michael Hudson. Former Wall Street analyst, professor of economics, a million books. He writes often about the FIRE economy, the acronym FIRE.
Okay.
Finance, insurance, and real estate. And his basic argument is, well, you know what? I want to get your reaction to this. So I'm going to read you very, very briefly. I hate to do this on the radio, but I am going to read you very briefly an excerpt of what he says here. He says, FIRE is an acronym for finance, insurance, and real estate. Basically, that sector is about assets, not production and consumption. Most people think of the economy as being producers making goods and services and paying labor to produce them. And then labor is going to buy these goods and services. It's a basic, a high school understanding of the economy. But this production and consumption economy is surrounded by the asset economy, the web of finance, insurance, and real estate, the FIRE economy, which is basically who in this mix actually owns assets, who owes debts, and to whom. The FIRE economy is dominated by finance. 70-80% of bank loans in North America and Europe are mortgage loans against real estate. So instead of a landowner class owning property clean and clear as they did in the 19th century, now we have a democratization of real estate. Two-thirds or more of the population owns their own home, but the only way to buy a home or commercial real estate is on credit. So the loan-to-value ratio goes up steadily. Banks lend more and more money to the real estate sector. A home or a piece of real estate or a stock or a bond becomes worth only whatever the banks are willing to lend against it. As the banks loosen their credit terms, as they lower interest rates, as they take lower down payments, lower amortization rates, with interest-only loans. This is where the bubble comes from. They're only going to lend more and more against property. So real estate gets bid up, but it's all on credit. So it's a huge bubble. Financialization of the FIRE economy also means that more and more of people's income and corporate and government tax revenue actually goes to creditors. So there's a flow of revenue out of the production and consumption economy and into the financial sector. So I'm not reading anymore. But okay. To me, what my reaction to this is here, this absolutely hits the big nail on the head. And this is, I think, the big thing that most Americans live, but they don't understand on a macro scale.
Mm-hmm.
That this is what is destroying the economy. This is what, and all of the platitudes that Hillary or Trump could throw out there aren't addressed to this. They're not talking about this. That our fundamentals of our economy have so drastically changed that we're now paying on debt for mm-hmm. everything. And so we've lost the engine that used to be there of actually making things, to get back to what we were talking about in the first hour, of making things and having a production-consumption economy. Now it's just a debt economy where less than 1% would benefit off of an economy like that.
Right. So there's a number of things there, right? So obviously the argument for liquidity is there. I mean, it's very difficult to think that we would have the same kind of economy that we do today if we didn't have that kind of liquidity through mortgage lending and things of that nature, right? I mean, I'm paying, 3-4% of, a little bit more, so that the bank has a little bit more to lend out to others.
So you're saying the credit allows a certain volume of growth that wouldn't be there without.
Right. Your debt is an asset.
In the same way, we have some point where you got to move off the gold standard and go to paper fiat money.
Exactly. So that liquidity helps at the end of the day. It just depends on where it's aimed at. And so you get into two different types of debt, consumptive debt and investment debt. Your investment debt is the good stuff, right? It's new roads. It's new schools. It's the kind of stuff that actually builds economies, right? Then you get the sort of consumptive debt where it's I'm blowing it on Cheetos and I'm paying for it with my credit card, things of that nature. That really you're consuming it, but it's not really paying you forward in any real means, right? And that's the real catch, right? Is that the middle class, your mortgage debt really isn't the problem. It's your credit card debt that's the problem at the end of the day. And that's where.
But what happens when the service on the investment debt mm-hmm. gets in the way of actually living a human life? I mean, and, Puerto Rico. There you go. It's Puerto Rico.
I think that we get to the third point. And this is there's a big difference between private and public debt, right? Private debt, and there's a lot of it out there. But we owe that to ourselves. We owe it to business as well. And as we saw in 2008, if a fraction of us defaults, it sends the whole system into turmoil and crunches that liquidity down to the point where all of us lead lesser lives at that rate from an economic point of view.
Which is what's happening in America.
That's exactly.
The dollar is worth less. The dollar you make today is worth less than it was in the 1970s.
And you're working
more for that dollar.
Right. And part of the problem of that, though, is because of the public debt, right? It's because we use inflation as a tool to make debt worth less, but it also makes my paycheck worth less as well. I mean, so you look at everybody that's been earning, $7.25 an hour or $5.25 before that, and you start tacking on inflation over that. I mean, in 1986, the dollar was worth twice as much as it is today. That has an impact on wages, right? And you start indexing things for inflation, you start figuring out that, our purchasing power really wasn't all that different than it was in the 1970s. That's a big problem. But the public debt in and of itself is a good portion of it's what we owe to ourselves. It's kind of printed by the Fed. We just start punching in zeros on a spreadsheet and ta-da, we have more money. Some of it's owned by foreign governments like Japan and China. Which is actually in and of itself an asset, because if they ever decide to do anything screwy, we just start printing money and it's like, yep. But they're actually spending their money on investment debt so that they can go ahead and ship more cheap crap to us. And then we, like fools, continue to buy it. Which leads to other capital problems, blah, blah, blah. But the central portion of debt in and of itself is not bad, right? I mean, if you buy a house, and it's worth, $300,000 or whatever the case may be, and you pay $600,000 on it over the course of 30 years, But then you have an asset at the end of it. That's a good kind of debt. That's the kind of debt that we want to try to encourage.
Assuming the house has...
assuming it has value, right.
Held its value, and its value has grown. Because if not, you're where people were in 2008, 2009.
That's exactly it. But
where they're underwater on their homes, and it doesn't make any sense to keep paying the mortgage.
Right, which I guess, you know, kind of comes back to a real fundamental point, though, is that economies are effectively built on people, right? You know, people doing great things, people kind of adding to the economy, creating value and things of this nature. Creating fewer people, obviously, is going to create less of a demand for homes. so this is why, you know, immigration on the balance is positive for an economy. It's not talking illegal or legal immigration, but just immigration as a whole. But these sort of things, you know, it's the people that are involved that fuel that economy. If they make wise choices, if they get good educations, if they become productive members of society, if they get the good kind of investment debt, if their local and state governments invest in the good kind of debt rather than the consumptive form of debt, they tend to build good societies. And when they go the other way, when they start kind of chasing their appetites and they start racking up the credit card bills and they buy the homes that they can't afford, and then, you know, their local and state governments are sort of, you know, floating the checkbook in order to get by, or buying things that they can't afford, or if we start investing too much in entitlements rather than the infrastructure, where things start going off the rails.
I think we're way past that, though. I think we're way past that. Most Americans, I'm certainly one of them, live paycheck to paycheck.
Sure.
Seven and a half out of every 10 Americans, or something like 7 or 8 out of every 10 Americans lives paycheck to paycheck. They're one car wreck, illness away from bankruptcy, where they just have no money. I don't think we're at a point where people are just splurging on, hey, let's go with their appetites. I think we were. Don't get me wrong. I think we were. I don't think we're there now. I think we're past that point. I think most people would love to be at a point where they could just feed their appetites and splurge like that. But I don't think most people are living that kind of life. I think most people are just getting by and barely paying the bills.
So I think, by and large, I agree. It's tough for most Americans out there. However, all that having been said, I think it's, you know, it'd be very difficult for me to find one of my friends or somebody around me who hadn't been to the movie theaters in the last month. Most everybody has a cell phone at this rate. It's a $600 cell phone. They roll it into their bill. They pay a good $100-$200 for their family plan, whatever, a month. Is that a necessity? Or is that a luxury? You know, it's you know, you start folding things like that in.
You don't have a phone plugged into the wall at home like we used to, which most people don't anymore. Then you could argue, well, that phone is necessity.
Yeah, but
it's the phone I used to have plugged into the wall at home. Now I just take it with me.
Yeah, it's $30 for a phone in the wall at home, right? I mean, that's the difference, right? You know, I mean, people, I mean, still seem to be buying things. I see people walking out of the Walmart with more crap than, you know, plastic crap than ever before. I think everybody, honestly, if they looked at their budget, could probably find a good 10% of it that they could probably cut and say, you know what, I don't need to.
But is that going to change their life? Is that going to fix this economy?
Well, it's not going to fix the economy, but it could change their life, right?
Are you bullish on the American economy?
I'm bullish on the American people. I'm not bullish on the American economy.
I think, Sean, I really believe this in my heart. I think we're screwed.
I don't think we're screwed.
If this continues like it has, let me just say that. No. If there's no changes, and I don't think Hillary represents change, and I don't think Trump. I think they both represent
they represent change.
The drama of change. You know what I mean? It's a show. It's just a show. If there's not really kind of serious fundamental change, where beginning with this very idea that corporations are too big, banks are too big to fail, and all this self-serving stuff that just protects oligarchs and protects, you know. I really do think it's screwed. We're screwed. That this is where social unrest comes from. Tremendous, scary social unrest. This is where it comes from. We know it from history. We know this from history, that when you look at history, when countries get to the point where it really starts to fall apart and the economy only benefits a small, small fraction of the people who make a ton of money and the rest of the people slip into becoming the working poor, which is where we are.
Mm-hmm.
That's where massive social unrest comes from. And I think it's generous to say that's where great revolutions come from. Maybe. Not guaranteed.
No.
It's where social unrest comes from.
Sure. So I mean, look at Venezuela, right? There's, you know, case in point. I mean, tremendous social unrest for a government that's working for a very limited few. But, you know, all that having been said there, I think there's something about the American character that tends to persevere through challenge. And I think that gives me a little bit more hope. I mean, look, it's not like the tools to change us aren't laying all around us, right? What really matters is that we kind of get past what the elites are telling us to care about, right? I mean, what's in the news right now? Transgender bathrooms.
Oh my God!
I don't care.
I don't either.
Don't make your problems my problems. It's really that simple, right? You use the bathroom you prefer. Just leave me alone.
Right.
How hard is this? When did we get away from basic common sense in this issue? But the bottom line here is that but there's so many other things that we have. I mean, the automation economy is coming. We're not really tackling that, and there's a very bad habit among the elites to pay attention to these problems when they think they can turn a buck off of it.
Yeah. And the liberals are totally wrong when that, just as a tangent, in that that automation economy, which is coming, whole sectors of our population are going to be out of a job because it's been automated. That is a freight train coming down the tracks. And the liberal idea, the whole liberal approach, championed by the liberals, but conservatives agree with it, is that, well, the solution to that, you hear Obama say it over and over again, the solution to that is education. You just got to get educated. You got to get, you. It's part of that whole idea of the technocrat and the fetishizing of an education beyond even what's reasonable. And the answer always isn't education. It's not always retraining you for a job, because that other job might not be there either.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, you've got to own your own means of production is the long and short of it, right? I mean, and whether that's education, whether it's certification, whether it's just kind of like hanging your own shingle, whatever the case may be. There's a lot to be said for that Henry Ford model of allowing your workers to go ahead and buy their own Model Ts.
Right.
We've got to, as a society, start aiming ourselves in that way. I mean, the world is about to change in a fairly radical way.
Huge.
People are going to make money off of this, obviously. But what happens to the working class? And, we've already absorbed a good 10% of our workforce. And you're seeing this in graphs. We've already hit, like, peak employment in the United States. It's already going back down the bell curve. We were at 68%, and now I think it's closer to 60% in terms of Americans that are actually, working right now. That trend is only going to continue. And so what happens at the end of that economy? Is it going to be that we have a lot of families with like one income families, so to speak, and is that really going to be the new future? Or what happens to everybody else, and what sort of purpose do they have? I'm still convinced that education is a big part of that solution, but it's going to take capital as well, right? I mean, somebody's got to be able to, if you've got the welder who's got the training, and they want to hang their shingle, somebody's going to have to be able to say, yep, here's your $10,000 loan to go ahead and make those dreams happen, and then bind them together with others.
But if education, like the investment debt for education, if that is financed in the same way everything else is becoming financed, then you have the situation where you got a 25-year-old with a phenomenal education who can't afford to do anything.
Right.
Because their income isn't part of the consumption production economy. It's part of the FIRE economy. It's part of the asset economy. It's going to Wall Street because all they're doing is paying on debt. So they can't afford to buy the new car. They can't afford to get out of the apartment.
Mm-hmm.
They can't afford to be a part of the engine of the economy. They're just stuck in being an engine for the 1% who makes money off of debt service.
So two things to that.
Is education then the answer?
It's part of it, right?
If it's all, financed.
It's one wheel to the bicycle, right? But you still got to have the other wheel. And that's got to be some sort of investment in the future. Whether that comes in, say, like microfinance, whether it's in the form of a guaranteed minimum income, which is being floated by the Swiss, which is an old Milton Friedman idea. So it's a conservative idea that says, everybody gets paid a certain amount that gets them above the poverty line. So that way people can actually go ahead and pursue these vocations.
That's what those liberals have been chanting in the streets, right? About raising the minimum wage. That's the basic idea, right? A living wage.
Yeah, well, a living wage is part of it too, right? Yeah. I mean, work ought to pay. I mean, if you're not doing, if you're underpaying your workers, and then you're asking government to meet the between, whether
then we all have to pick up.
Then everybody has to pick up the
tab. Which is why Walmart is the biggest beneficiary of social welfare in America.
Which is also why they up their wage, right? Because somebody figured it out and said, "Oh, wait, you know, government really is subsidizing a lower wage. This makes more sense." So I mean, but you know, I got to think that the ingenuity of the American worker. I mean, we tend to think of things in terms of like looking at the past and think, you know, more welders and more, you know, this, that, and the other. Yeah, 15 years ago, you know, maybe, you know, the future was more coders. You know, but who would have really thought that big data was really that much of our future, right? I got to think that the solutions are just things that we just haven't arrived at yet, and that there is a new economy. We can't just be Luddites throwing rocks at the machines.
Yeah. We can't. But what do you do with these millions of people? They're at the Trump rallies. They're at the Bernie rallies. They know it's broken. They know this system no longer serves them. They know the economic system no longer serves them. They know the political system no longer serves them. They know the politics and the economics is like the old church and state working together in the Middle Ages to keep a very, very small...
That's a good analogy.
It's a very, very small fraction of the population happy, fat, and wealthy. And that's where we were in the 15th century. That's where we are in the 21st century. And I totally believe in the smarts of the average American. They get it. They're not stupid. Mm-hmm. They get it. They understand we're being screwed. They get it on the left. They get it on the right. They have different solutions, and they've got different people they point to for being responsible. But they all know, whether they're chanting for Bernie or they're chanting for Trump, they know this system no longer serves me. Yeah. It no longer even cares about me.
Yeah.
And that's where scary social unrest comes from. Well, if it's not fixed, if that's where it all starts to come apart.
Yeah. What'll scare me though is that when we start pointing at one another and saying you're the problem or I'm the problem.
It's already happening though.
Yeah, we already, but that's the way.
And that's what Trump's run on
people
that.
People profit off of that sort of contest,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
the problems that most Americans are facing are not problems that their neighbors have created for them, right? Regardless of their political opinions. And this is where I think to a large degree localism is going to be the grand solution at the end of the day.
Yeah. And I agree with that. I think this big next American revolution, which we can talk about, I do believe that it starts locally, and it may just have a local face. It may never have a national
iteration.
It's
just going to have a devolution of power at the end of the day, right? I trust my neighbors more than I trust any bureaucrat in Washington. But that, I think, is the grand solution. And there's a lot of
people... Because they're in it with you, and the bureaucrat in Washington is not.
Exactly, and they're living the same life that I am, and they experience the same weather. Their children play with mine. I mean,
they're sitting in the same traffic as we speak. Yeah, and that's not your enemy. Regardless of their politics,
right.
That's not your enemy.
Or their faith, or their viewpoints, or the color of their skin, or whatever, or whatever we imagine divides us, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of people further up in New York and Washington and Chicago and San Francisco that would love to pit us against one another, and they make a lot of money doing it. And that, I think, is where if we focus on that, if that's the way this ends, then I'm worried. But if we sort of invert it and say, you know what, you know, whatever happens, we will stick through and we will bear it out, just turning to your neighbors and friends and coworkers and colleagues. And I think localism is really where the grand fix and a devolution of power. Because, I mean, let's face it. I mean, Washington, just Richmond, you know, you name it, they don't get it right. And they get it wrong more often than otherwise. I mean, this is the...
If you're Dominion Virginia Power, they get it right every time. If you're Comcast, they get it right every time,
and they pay millions of dollars to convince you of this.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is that we've got more tools. And again, we said this at the beginning of the conversation. We have more tools today than anyone else and of any other generation before us to fix the problems that we've created. And every problem that we're facing, you know, they were made by human beings. They can be fixed by human beings. And so there's that kind of basic Jeffersonian optimism that comes through. Yeah, are things bad? Yes, they are. But you know, we've got all the right people around us. We just haven't met them yet.
And Jefferson remained optimistic about the revolution in France until the realities of the blood convinced him otherwise.
Yep.
And then he actually realized, you know what? That their only saving grace right now is a Napoleon, is a military dictator. Because look what happens without it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm talking about. This kind of stuff gets really scary, ugly. And a kind of world that has has existed time and time again, and we fool ourselves so naively to think that it couldn't happen here. It could absolutely happen here. France in the 1790s, where you have a literal class war,
mm-hmm.
where, I mean, priests and nuns are being, you know, driven at gunpoint and at the point of a sword into lakes and mass drownings.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's sickening and frightening to think about, but people are, if average regular people are so pushed to the point where they're so shut out of the world, they get angry. They get angry and they get desperate.
Yeah, look at the Spanish Civil War. I mean, from the 1930s, it's you know, you literally had two sides pitted against one another. I mean, mass killings on both sides, right?
Yeah.
But this is what happens when we spin ourselves up in our own rhetoric, and you know, it's easy to do. There's a lot of money being thrown at us, whether it's TV or, you know, Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, whatever the case may be. But there's a lot of money being thrown at us to do that, to pit ourselves against our neighbors, and that just strikes me as a foolish enterprise. But people believe it, and it's happened throughout history. You're absolutely right. The secular religions do have their pull, and but that's the one thing. I mean, that's the clue to resist it. When it stops being a disagreement and it starts becoming, you know, more than just an argument, when it's, you know, you have that visceral hatred of the other, and for political purposes or whatever the case may be, that's where, you know, you've got to, whether it's yourself or others, you've got to look at those people and just kind of hit the pause button and say, that's not the way we want to go.
Am I right in saying that you, as a Republican and as a conservative, that's a big reason why you will never support Donald Trump?
Oh, of
because
course.
He's actually run on that whole idea. Appealing to the worst of our natures.
Of course, it's and this is from a man that openly supports. I mean, likes Mussolini, right? Kept his biography next to his bedstand. You know, you don't fight class socialism with national socialism, and that's unfortunately what Trump has really done is he's preyed upon our fears rather than pointed towards the angels of our better nature. I mean, there's nothing Lincoln.
And it's what demagogues do.
That's exactly right.
Hitler, Mao, Stalin. I mean, you go down the list. They all do the same playbook. It's the demagogue playbook.
Yeah, and American leaders have never done that, right? I mean, Lincoln, the angels of our better nature, which I guess was more of a Jefferson quote, but still. I mean, Lincoln never did that. Teddy Roosevelt never did that. FDR never did that. Kennedy never did that. Reagan never did that. Obama never did that. You know, each and every single president, I mean, you know, Clinton never did that. Bush 43 never did that, for crying out loud. I mean, each and every single president has always pointed to, like, a better future, and you finally got a major nominee that's come around and say, no, the future's worse than ever before, and here are the people to blame, and here's who we're going to string up. That just strikes me as antithetical to everything that we believe as Americans, and yet he's carrying the battle standard of a major party.
How in the world do you make sense of that? And the really, just, I don't even have a word for it. But the part that mystifies me the most is watching the party leaders and Republicans supplicate
all
to
kneel.
Him. Yeah, kiss his ring. It's like, really? Why can't you just make a stand and say, you may be the nominee, but I will not support you.
Paul Ryan, Speaker Ryan's about the only person, and even he had to go into a meeting and sit down and, you know, come out with some sort of, you know, accommodating statements like, we're working towards unity. I don't want unity with people like this. You know, there's a good friend of mine who's like, you know, like the whole seven stages and all of that. And he's like, he's on the way to acceptance. It's like, I'm sorry. I'm still stuck at denial. because there's something there's something fundamental about his candidacy that I just can't get over. It's that he anathemizes the other and uses that as a political wedge to determine who his friends are and who they are not. And I've said it once, I'll say it again. It's like when good people, like, you know, like there's certain individuals that are libertarians, others, you know, friends of mine that are Catholics, priests, whatever the case may be, when they no longer feel comfortable in the Republican Party and the David Dukes of the world do, that's a problem. That's a huge problem. I mean, I cannot reconcile that. And that there are certain individuals that are more than happy to bring those types of individuals in. When you have New York Times editors writing columns and then getting rocks thrown at them from anti-Semites on Twitter and Facebook, that's a problem. And for the major nominee of our party not to be able to stand up, or of the Republican Party at this rate, to not be able to stand up and say definitively, it's wrong, I will not tolerate it, and I do not want their support.
And it's the same thing on the left. If the average American blue-collar worker no longer feels at home in the party that was always supposed to be about we the people,
them. Yeah.
The party that was actually created by the working class to balance out the mm-hmm. the really unrealistic hegemony and power of the oligarchs and the CEOs and corporate America. It was that one thing that spoke for the people. When that person no longer feels at home in the Democratic Party,
right.
and yet the CEO does, you know,
what do you
then
do?
You get a candidacy like Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton,
yeah.
who, beginning with the DLC in the 80s, they sold out the Democratic Party.
And what kills me in that equation, too, is that you got a lot of these blue-collar Dems and whatnot, the independents, the old Reagan Democrats, the Jim Webb Democrats, they're starting to matriculate over to Trump. And it's like, I don't understand that. This man doesn't believe what you believe. He's using you. But they walk yeah. over anyway.
And I'm not convinced he even believes what he says.
And neither am I.
You know?
This is just the last unconquered hill, right? And he'll say what he has to say in order to
win.
He's
done so many reality TV shows. He knows how to play this.
Yeah.
It's just a reality TV show. You know,
yeah.
And then we're back to Orwell and... but it's just this show. It's this game that there doesn't have to be reality to it.
Yeah, I mean the politicians got punked at their own game. There's just nothing else to say or do. It's they got punked by a snake oil salesman. They just knew how to play the game better than they did. That's all.
He's going to be the nominee of the Republican Party.
I have nothing.
He's going to be the nominee.
I have absolutely nothing. And I keep, getting it put to me. It's like, when he's the nominee, you got to make a decision, Sean. It's like, I'm not there.
And
I am not there.
The protesting Democrats in the streets, where is this going to be? Cleveland or whatever? Outside?
Oh, yeah. This is going to be our Chicago.
They're only going to make it worse.
Oh, yeah.
They're only going to make it worse by protesting Trump and breaking stuff. And they're only going to make it worse. I mean, it's just so...
Which is the point, right? Because if for a certain segment of the political left, I mean, this is where you get to harder, soft Marxist, right? I mean, this sort of violence is endemic to political struggle, right? It's what's necessary.
And it empowers the demagogue.
And then
makes
empowers
someone
the
like
demagogue,
Trump
right?
stronger.
Which is how the national... Again, this is why Mussolini came up with national socialism, because instead of using class struggle to divide, you use patriotism. And there was an article, it was yesterday, I think I shared it on Facebook, it was a political article talking about how the two major parties are sort of mixing at this rate, or we're in the process of a realignment. But you're starting to see that, and people looking at their worldview through the lens of class, whether they're working class, middle class, whatever the case may be, and then the other ones are using patriotism as the fulcrum to go ahead and view their solutions and their worldview. The two really don't have, I don't want to say effective values at the end of the day. That might be too strong, but they'll mold their values to fit in with that worldview. And it's kind of what you saw like in the wake of 9/11, right? Where it's all, eagles and flags and explosions and all of that. Kind of an appeal to patriotism, and those who are not, sufficiently patriotic were just not sufficiently American. It's that same thing that put George Bush over the top in 2004. It's the same impulse that's rankled Republicans because we used it in 2000 and 2004. And it rankled Republicans in 2008 when it didn't work against
Obama. It's the same impulse that lifted so many Allegiant hands in Germany in the 30s. Hitler was about patriotism.
And lifts them today in pledging their vote to Donald Trump.
Yeah.
but that's exactly what it is. It's, things suck, so we've got to go ahead and appeal to patriotism because this is the only God we know. And
the economy's not working. It really is a sign, I think, I'm not going to say end times, but because I don't mean it biblically.
A national
malaise. But that the economy truly has broken. That it no longer serves people.
But it's transitioning.
Because what do you have then after that? Oh, well, we can wrap ourselves in the flag.
Yeah, but it's transitioning, right? And we've gone through this kind of transition before. I mean, we did it. I mean, the industrial age obviously was a late 19th century sort of deal, but we never really had that connection between labor and finance until about 1919 with the first, the 1920s, right? The early part of the 1920s, we had that first, depression, so to speak, but we snapped right out of it because we let it fail. In the 1929 and 1932, we didn't let it fail. scale, but we transitioned into like the New Deal economy, right? We transitioned into the industrialized society that say like Germany under Bismarck did in the 1880s, right? It took us another 50 years to get to that point to start developing a social welfare state and things of this nature. But a lot of that's because we were no longer an agrarian society. I mean, more of our people were living in cities than ever before. We are now no longer truly.
What China's going through now.
Yeah. We're no longer truly an industrialized society. We're a service economy. And so what's happening is that as we're transitioning into that and things become more automated and such, the economy's got to change and there's going to be some friction. I mean, it's not like there's a bonus army sitting on the National Mall in Washington.
Can you have a nation of 300 million people in a service economy?
Yes, you can.
With any prospects for people actually making a living?
Yes, you can.
And life getting better and social Absolutely. Mobility being a real thing?
Absolutely, provided you do not centralize power. You've got to have the wisdom of those individuals, whether it's a Jefferson or a Madison or Henry Ford or somebody else or Reagan, who's able to go ahead and take that sort of collectivism and give it back to the people. Give them their yeoman farms, right? Give them their Model T. Give them a degree of localism where they feel like they have a control of their own destiny. I mean, again, the tools are all around us. We're just not applying them.
This is such an utterly Jeffersonian idea. For those who haven't read Jefferson to the degree that you and I have, I mean, this is what he was all about.
Right.
Yeah, this is what he was all about. Keep power local. That way people can be involved in it and control it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it becomes removed and distant and foreign, then you're just going to recreate the Middle Ages. He said you'll create, what's the quote? You'll create, I don't remember the exact quote, but you'll basically recreate a nation that will be worse than the one we revolted against.
Yes.
And that's where we are.
Yes. And that's exactly it. So, and this is, I mean, you see it with Trump and Clinton and everybody else. It's not that people are, I mean, people don't like the way things are, but they don't understand how the economy works. They certainly don't understand how the finance economy works. They don't understand how their government works. I mean, you've got all these Trump supporters waving around their constitution saying, the conservatives never kept their promises. Like, well, you can't do a whole lot with one half of one third of the government, right? When you have a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate and a Supreme Court that is not going to go ahead and get rid of Obamacare, you don't have a whole lot to work with. But they don't understand fundamentally how the nature of compromise and how politics works. In order to give them that education, you've got to teach them how to be good citizens again.
But if your politics is based on so demonizing your political opponent, compromise becomes impossible because you can't compromise with the devil.
Because the stakes are too high and they don't understand what's at work. If you were to go ahead and take those same kinds of issues and bring them down to a local level, right? And put like 300 people in a room and make it a parliament of some type, right? And then have them look over each and every single issue as a parliament might. I think you'd have much more civil discourse. But as it stands right now, I mean, these decisions are locked away with, 535 people in a nation of 300 million people that are then devolved to 140 people in each state legislature, thereabouts, that are then devolved to boards and councils of seven, really, all across the Commonwealth of Virginia.
And they're not listening to the people. They just listen to the money.
Yeah,
they listen to the lobbyists. They listen to the corporations.
Sure.
What the policies they enact do not benefit the vast majority of people.
Because they're going back to ALEC and they're going, it's like, I don't understand this. I don't, I have 3,000 bills I got to look at. You tell me what to think.
Well, and they follow the money too. They're constantly fundraising and they know, hey, I can get a lot of money from this company if I help make this legislation happen that's going to make them a lot wealthier and avoid this,
And people don't want to learn how to operate their own government because there's nothing in it for them. And let's face it, elected officials are expendable. I can get one out and somebody else is willing to make a new set of promises, put them back in, right? And then have them renege on their promises over time, trade that one out for whoever's next. But that's really it. I think what was the number of actual elected officials in the United States, something on the order of like, I don't know, I think it's like 20,000 or something like that.
I mean, that's it. Out of 300 million,
right? I mean, and you think about it, like, during the time of the founding era, like Virginia had a population of what, 250,000?
So then is the next revolution about maybe coming up with a different kind of system?
Expanding the franchise?
So that it's no longer a republic, which is a very 18th century idea that was very self-serving for an elite class. And it's no longer a democracy. Maybe it's something else. I mean, they invented those ideas.
A little bit of both.
Do we need to invent something else?
So we've enfranchised the vote, right? And so, you know, now more people have a say than ever than in the whole history of humankind, right? We've enfranchised the vote, but we haven't enfranchised representation. I'm not so sure that we're quite there for a direct democracy. I mean, the founders were effectively right in that. Direct democracy typically fails because it's just a mob at the end of the day.
Mr. Hamilton, yeah, don't be so negative.
Or Mr. Madison, at the same token, it doesn't mean that in Virginia at least 8.8 million people need to be governed by 140 people in Richmond. To some degree, a devolution of power works, and then enfranchising more people to make those decisions, especially with so many of us here. That works, and it matters. It matters a great deal.
I couldn't agree more that part of the solution for the future is devolving the power out of Washington and out of Richmond to the local level. I do agree with that. Corporate America hates that idea, of course, but because it's harder to control people, it's harder to control markets. They want to control markets in Vietnam or Iraq just as much as they want to in Charlottesville or Winchester. But I also think that I totally lost my train of thought.
Well, it's also easier to control too. In balkanize. I mean, look at state and local debt, for instance. I mean, you've got people. I mean, immediately after the budget, 2008, 2009, after the bubble burst, what happened? Everybody started going to state and local governments saying, "Hey, you should take out loans and bonds and do this and do that at 5-6% interest." And everybody kind of fell in line. I mean, the bubble that's grown for municipal debt is huge right now. But the problem is, again, is that you've only got, on these, there's like 7, 9, 11 people on a city council in Detroit, for instance, making these decisions. What have you had?
Oh, I know what I was going to say. Sorry to interrupt you. But no. I think this idea that there will be this class of people, this small minority of people who will make those decisions for everybody else is inherently a medieval idea. And you can't fault the guys in the 18th century. What we should see, hopefully, is we should see that as a transition period out of the Middle Ages, that it was this giant step away from that, but we still have giant steps to go to truly empowering people. Mm-hmm. And they only went so far, which is why the history of America is this constant push for more. Women should have the right to vote. No, Native Americans should have the right to vote. No, people of color should have the right to vote. I mean, you're constantly having to push back against this medieval system that was built, by a bunch of rich white guys in the 18th century.
Sure. But it's just like Ford and the Model T. I think the more people that own Model Ts, the more people that own a slice of that government.
That's it.
And can go back and explain it to their neighbors.
That's it.
The better off we're going
to
be.
And, hats off again to Jefferson for all his faults. This is what he wrote about constantly.
That's right.
That people need to have a stake. They need it, which is why, he said in an era when you couldn't vote unless you had property, his solution was, well, the government should buy a bunch of property and give it away to people.
Give it away.
Because you want you need to make sure that people are at the table, mm-hmm. because when they're not, then they get angry.
That's exactly it.
Yeah. And that's where it all starts to fall apart.
Yep.
It's 5 minutes to 6 o'clock, Sean Kenny.
I know.
How about that?
I know.
Hey, thanks for coming in today. This was a lot of fun.
No, this was a lot of fun. This was a lot of fun.
And we do it every Monday, and you are welcome anytime. Lord knows what we're going to talk about, but this is how we roll.
This is
these
how it
days.
Rolls. Yeah,
yeah. How is your life going? Is it going well?
Exceptionally well.
What are you doing this summer?
Nothing.
You're not going to Paris? You're not getting on the private jet and taking Missy to Paris?
Yes. I'm going. Yeah. Surprise, Missy! We're going to Paris. I might go to vacation down in Nag's Head or Crawla Beach or something like that in late August.
Go.
But we're working. The good. I mean, I'm not taking any classes at the university this semester. For the summer. So
take a rest.
I get to read what I want to read now. So I'm catching up on all these books that I've slowly bought and have been sitting next to my bedside.
Tom Frank has a new book out. The guy who wrote What's the Matter with Kansas?
Yeah.
A good friend of mine. It's called Listen Liberal. And it's really how the Democratic Party sold out the working class and sucked up to Wall Street and how, the Clintons are corrupt. And it's a fantastic book.
See,
I
want the old Democratic Party back.
So does Tom Frank.
So the one that says, it's like, God bless the two greatest institutions on the earth, the Democratic Party and the Catholic Church. And the response is, and what's the other one? Where's that Democratic Party?
But you need it. Somebody said to me recently on Facebook, like, we need a third party in Charlottesville. And I'm like, no. You just need to take back the ones that were sold illegally. That's all you need to do. I mean, liberals need to, the working class, not necessarily the working class, like the But the people need to take back the People's Party.
Yeah.
And the true conservatives need to take back the GOP.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the true conservatives before Reagan, before really movement conservatism. Because movement conservatism, by definition, moves. It's going to constantly keep moving. And it will only feel like it has realized itself if it keeps moving to the right. And then you fast forward a few decades, you go from Reagan to Trump.
Yeah, the problem is movement conservatism needed an enemy. And we had that with the Soviet Union. And then we had that with Al-Qaeda. And they're both gone. And now we don't have it there to keep the paper right on anymore.
And now it's just brown people, whether they're from south of the border or from the Middle East. It just becomes this, you know, it's just another, it's the latest 21st century version of 19th century racism.
I am glad, though, to see the certain segment of the conservative movement snapped off from that. When you go, oh, we need to get rid of the brown people, and everybody goes, whoa, wait a second. Yeah. We don't do that in America.
That's SeanKenney.com. It's BearingDrift.com as well. Sean, thank you, sir, for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And what we'll do is we'll get out of here so you can have AP News coming up next, followed by Democracy Now! No AP News. We're going to go straight to Democracy Now! In just a few moments. So stay right here at 94.7 WPVC.